From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning on The Mountain Life, we're taking a look back at health and wellness over the last 12 months. We'll revisit several conversations, some of our favorite, one with Dr. Nicole Kane on managing anxiety in an integrative and no-nonsense way. Then cultural historian Elsa Richardson takes us into the story of the body's most fascinating organ, the gut. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our guest is naturopathic physician, Dr. Nicole Kane. Nicole is a pioneer on integrative approaches for mental and emotional wellness. Her approach to mental health is multidisciplinary, medical, psychological, and holistic. She joins us today to talk about a holistic approach to ridding ourselves of anxiety. She will take us through the 9 types of anxiety and share her bottom-up repatterning, an approach to mental health that focuses on regulating the body to heal the mind due to their profound interconnectedness. She's written a new book about it called Panic Proof. Dr. Nicole Kane, welcome to The Mountain Life.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this idea that there are multiple types of anxiety. Who knew? I think we imagine anxiety is just that kind of bubbling nervousness that many of us get in certain situations. Tell us a little bit about how you've discovered that this is separated into many different types.
Well, one of the biggest myths about anxiety is that I don't have anxiety, that we don't experience it. And so when I was working with clients over the past 15 plus years, people would come in and they would be describing these symptoms of autonomic arousal, where their body is kind of going into that fight, flight, freeze. But it was a little bit different for everyone. And I thought it would be interesting if we took a look at all of the research and just explored, are there any unifying themes with these different types of presentations on anxiety? And if that's the case, does it add value to the anxiety freedom conversation? And it turns out that it does.
Wonderful. So what would be the first way that somebody who suspects they're feeling certain kinds of anxiety could start to discover where in that matrix they might fall?
The first thing is to be aware and to acknowledge our body and our mind and our emotional sensations. We live in a culture where anxiety is seen as the problem, and we really quickly jump to solutions to try to make it stop, to try to make it go away. And we see a couple of things happening with that in the literature. One is what we deny will amplify, and what we resist will persist. And so there's a gift in allowing ourselves to notice and acknowledge what we feel. So by default, just acknowledging it can be therapeutic for anxiety. And then secondarily is when we acknowledge it, we get a little bit more clarity and understanding about what the body is telling us is going on. Again, the 9 types is a really nice way to organize that information. And I'd love to explain that more.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Nicole Kane. She is a naturopathic physician, and she's written a new book called Panic Proof. We're talking about anxiety and the subtypes of anxiety. Now, Nicole, when I saw the 9 types of anxiety, I thought, well, okay, there's social anxiety. Let's see, there's... And then I stopped.
Yes.
But this is not at all what you're talking about. You're talking about types of anxiety throughout our body. So we have to get in touch with where we're feeling it in our body. Can you expand on that?
Yes. And I appreciate the nuance that you just pointed out here is the difference between a conventional diagnosis of anxiety, which we have those symptoms laid out in a book called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And so the DSM essentially has generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and then just sort of a smattering of in between. And so the 9 types of anxiety is looking at the ways uniquely that anxiety can show up, as you said, the different systems it can present in. And I want to give an example, if I may, about how we're already doing this in clinical practice, but we might not really realize it because the conversation just hasn't been formulated. And so generally, somebody has anxiety. Let's say that they have gut anxiety, and they get that knowing in their stomach, that kind of butterflies in their stomach, but then it can amplify into full-fledged panic where they have terrible diarrhea or heartburn or gas and bloating. If they go to the doctor, the conventional doctor's been trained, the gas and bloating is a problem, so we'll send them to a gastroenterologist to take care of that. And then we treat the emotional symptoms. We treat the anxiety, oftentimes with maybe an antidepressant or talk therapy. And we could do a little better, and we see this. So let's say in the example of somebody with chest anxiety, their heart is pounding out of their chest, just skipping beats. They're worried they're going to have a heart attack. They go to the doctor. The doctor knows about chest anxiety. They can give them something called propranolol, a beta blocker, which will help the heart not pound so violently when they're anxious. And so just by knowing, even with our current nomenclature, just by knowing the little bit of nuance in how it presents is already giving us information about diagnosis and treatment. And so I know we've been kind of talking about the 9 types from a sky view, and those are 2 of them.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You say that one of the 9 types is the immune system. And this is interesting because we're on the rise with all of these crazy autoimmune diseases. And of course, makes one wonder, what is the connection to anxiety? Can you go into that a little bit?
I'm really passionate about this for the exact reasons that you said, is we are seeing so much inflammation, immune system dysfunction. We're seeing some long haul symptoms that can occur after infections. And here's something that many of us might relate to. So if anybody listening to this conversation is just checking with yourself, do you ever experience itchy eyes, runny nose, post-nasal drip, maybe sneezing? So those, we can say, oh yeah, those are my allergies. They're coming out right now. They're driving me nuts. But what you might not know is that that same chemical, histamine, that's causing these allergy symptoms could also be causing anxiety. Histamine can be as activating to your nervous system as adrenaline. And so immune system anxiety, if you want to get to the root cause of that anxiety, that person who has allergies and anxiety, if they go to the doctor and they just get an antidepressant or do talk therapy, we're missing a giant opportunity to listen to the symptoms of the body and to say, okay, why? Why do we have immune system anxiety? And what can we do about it?
Right. And so in using that example, how would you address that with a client?
Yeah. Yeah. So somebody comes in and they say, oh, I've had the worst allergies. I've been having insomnia. I've been having panic attacks. This is really common in my perimenopausal, postmenopausal patients. And the first question we ask is, well, one is, do you have high histamine? An allergist can confirm this. And so they come in. So you have high histamine. Why do you have high histamine? And so when we look at the brain, the body, and the nervous system, and we look at the trauma-informed research, it's coming out with amazing works like The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, right? We look at the trauma-informed neuroscience, and we know that the body has adapted to something, and that adaptation is continuing to be played out today. And so number one is, why is that adaptation coming out in immune system anxiety, and what do we do about it? And then number two is, how do we go and reverse engineer that? And so it's kind of a multi-prong process.
Wow, that is so interesting. So there are both long-term approaches that are systemic, as well as probably some acute treatments that you recommend for clients. In this case of somebody who was having trouble with insomnia and histamines and something like that, how might both of those different approaches arise?
Yeah, a conventional practitioner might say, try hydroxyzine. And so they would give you a prescription for hydroxyzine. And so if that helps you fall asleep, that's bringing down inflammation. And so then they may treat that. But I think we could take it a step further. And if we look at the physiology, if we look at the science of histamine, we know that histamine can come into the body from the environment. It could come in from environmental toxins. It can come in from high histamine foods like citrus. Who knew, right? And then secondarily, our body can produce histamine. We have a whole host of gut microbes that are living their best lives, producing all sorts of neurochemicals, regulating your gut-brain axis, communicating with your immune system, your hormones. So your gut might be producing histamine. And then the third reason histamine might be high is if you aren't properly detoxifying histamine. And there are three pathways that really need to be leveraged to drain histamine out so that you're not bubbling over with histamine symptoms.
Just one response to that. I used to feel a little bit of social anxiety, and I thought that it made me, my cheeks flush and things like that. But what I discovered was that often I would have a cocktail or something at the beginning of a social event, and that I am one of those people who doesn't break down acetylcholine very well in my system. And so I was getting all flushed because of my, you know, self-medicating before a social event. And so I really am responding to what you're talking about.
Yes. And isn't that life-changing and empowering? Instead of being like, well, my body is rebelling and I can't even calm down with a cocktail. Yeah. Instead, you could be really mindful, which I know you are because you discovered this, because you did deeper digging to say, okay, my body isn't as efficient at breaking down acetylcholine. How can I support that process so that if I choose to have a drink, then I won't have now layers upon layers of symptoms?
And my red face won't make me even more anxious.
Exactly. People won't be like, are you okay? And then you're like, ah, no, actually I'm not.
Well, let's pretend that we're in your office. I'm going to ask you a further question about Mary Beth's condition, which would be, would you then imagine that if she has a cocktail just when she's at home and relaxed and in a very comfortable environment, would she get the same flushed cheeks?
Ooh, this is a really good question. And I feel like we might need to do an experiment just to see. So no, your homework.
It's too early in the morning to have a cocktail.
There's something, it's called the stress diathesis model. And we think about this in the image. I like to use the metaphor of a cup with marbles on the inside. And so we all come into life and we have a cup, and that cup represents how much stress we're able to hold. And the marbles inside of the cup represent diathesis or risk factors. And so these risk factors take up space for the stress of life, which is going to represent the water pouring into the cup. So if you have lots of factors that are going in, for example, maybe you have poor liver detoxification and you have a backlog of things that your body's been trying to eradicate, but you don't have the enzymatic or the microbiota support. And so your cup is already full of marbles. And then maybe you just got a deadline that just got pushed forward and you're like, oh my gosh. And so now your body is producing cortisol. And then that cortisol is putting you into autonomic arousal and it's suppressing inflammation. And so now your immune system is being suppressed. And so then your kid came in from a new day at school, got a little bit of something and coughed on you. And so now, so right, we have these multivariables. And so now your cup is full. And so the question that you asked, Lynn, is a really good question. It's like, okay, well, then if I go out and I socialize and I have a glass of wine in this situation versus if I just went to Bali and laid on the beach and did yoga and took out as many of these marbles as possible, would the effect be the same? And I think the most high integrity answer of that is it depends on the person. We would have to see.
Yeah, I would say beta tests, being more relaxed, yeah, and being in the, yes, right, like stress-free environment absolutely affects that for me.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, one of the types of anxiety that you mention is anger as anxiety, which I find really interesting. We recently in our very small community had a very shocking road rage incident in which an innocent person lost their life. It's unfathomable to me to think that someone could get that angry in their car. It's just left me with this big question. What happens? Why are we so angry? Or why are some people so angry?
Right. Yeah, I feel like this is such an important question to ask, because when we talk about fight, flight, freeze, and then there's also for fun, flop, fawn, and fracture, these responses of the autonomic nervous system when we go into arousal, is a lot of us are familiar with the freeze, like a deer in headlights when I get anxious, or fight flight, where I'm going to run away or escape. I'm in a social anxiety situation. Oh, my Uber's here, got to go. But the fight we don't often talk about in context of autonomic arousal. We often talk about it in context of behavior. And so one is that the chemicals that get released during autonomic arousal are fairly similar, depending on if you're running away from danger or if you're freezing in danger, as if you're fighting in danger. And so the question is what happened or didn't happen to you in your past, or what is happening or isn't happening to you in your present that has resulted in an adaptation where this is necessary and beneficial for you? And so specific examples of that may be when you were younger, maybe that's the behavior that you learned in your culture, in your family environment. Maybe that was the only safe behavior. If you exhibited other behaviors, you would be hurt or in danger or punished. And we see this when we think about the different causes of anxiety, is there's biological causes. So we talked about histamine. There's psychological causes. And so we could talk about our family environment and how we were treated and our self-esteem, but there are also societal and environmental causes. And so what's happening in our culture and in our society where people are becoming so activated that they're engaging in these egregious acts? And I think a big point about this is we have a real opportunity to teach about the stoplight strategies, is how I kind of define them, of autonomic arousal, to see if we could start helping people when they're in the beginning whispers of arousal before it turns into shouts and they have road rage and do something really dangerous and harmful.
Very interesting. Do you believe, Nicole, that we can deal with any type of anxiety without being medicated for anxiety?
Yeah. You know what? I think medications have been life-saving for so many people. In fact, Lexapro is a SSRI antidepressant, and that was life-saving for me. And so if you find that that's your story and that these antidepressants have given you your life back, then that's incredible. And I encourage people to, instead of saying, okay, well, my story is I have to take Zoloft the rest of my life, period, at the end of my sentence, I'm just going to have to manage anxiety the rest of my life, is this book and what my mission is and what I've seen time and time again across the world, I've worked with patients all around the world, is that if we put a semicolon at the end of that sentence, we can do even better. And some people, many people, make the choice to pursue anxiety freedom with medications, and many choose it without medications. And so it really depends on that unique individual and what gives them most life, most freedom. It's all about taking back your power and how that looks for you.
That's so interesting. In another part of my life, I work with musicians and speakers sometimes, and their number one issue is stage fright. Every time. Yeah. Everyone's so concerned about this. They have something they really want to say or want to perform, but this holds them back.
And one of the techniques that I've heard about and used with them over the years is reframing it as just energy, right? You're never tired when you're nervous because you feel this bubbling energy, and just to try to look at it as a source of energy. But what else? What are some other things that we could do in the moment if you're feeling suddenly kind of a panic or an anxiety feeling before something that you need to do?
Yeah. So before you've gone up and you're about ready to go on stage, or before they're about ready to hit that button that says we're live, is that you will have practiced learning how to go into activation, to go into excitement, to go into arousal and bring yourself out. Just like your area of genius is musicians, for an example, they've played these songs thousands of times. They could probably play them in their sleep. And so when it comes to regulating our body, regulating our nervous systems, is that we can be rehearsing this. And in his book, The Body Keeps a Score, he talks about these so-called involuntary mechanisms. So this is our heart rate, this is our respiratory rate, our body temperature. We can regulate that by working with the body. And so you were talking about a very important intervention, a top-down. I'm excited. I'm relabeling it. I need this energy in order to perform. It's safe. We're fine. You've got this. You've done it before. So those top-down strategies, we also want to pair with the body, because many of us have had that experience of, why do I feel completely restless and jittery and sick to my stomach, even though logically I know it's fine? So we work with the body. And one of my favorite quick hacks that I can leave us with today is vagus nerve work. And so I teach people to create a panic pack. And in that, it'll be a little bag that you can carry with you. And in that bag, you're going to have all sorts of things that are going to bring you back into your body, stimulate the brain stem. My favorite of which is a cold pack. You can get them for first aid kits. And when you get them out and shake them up, they get really cold, and then you place that on your face, around your eyes, 30 seconds, maybe on your chest, the back of your neck. We see that that activates the mammalian dive response, which will shift you out of autonomic arousal, out of fight, flight, freeze, and back into your calm and grounded self.
Wow, is that fascinating. I think the sensory things make sense. And you hear about, you know, noticing your senses, but I love that. That's very visceral. You can jump right in, put one of those in your car or your purse or whatever. That is fascinating.
Yes.
Do you think that some people are kind of empathic almost with anxiety, that they pick it up from people around them, or is it always internally sourced?
You ask the best questions. There was a research study that I was just reading last week, and they were looking at how some people have adapted to be anxious. And they looked at MRI brain scans, and they saw that some people, there was a correlation between larger amygdala size and greater amounts of empathy and anxiety. And so the amygdala is one of the parts of the brain responsible for emotional processing. And so when they have a larger amygdala, we notice that people can have bigger feelings of anxiety, bigger attunement to what's going on interoceptively in their body and in their environment. And so this superpower that makes them incredibly attuned and empathic could also be a kryptonite that they have to learn to wield that can make them more predisposed to anxiety.
You were talking about picking up anxiety from others. We think about just our dogs, our pets that pick up on our anxiety. And we can only credit them with having the brain function that of a toddler. So it makes sense that we have that kind of empathic anxiety. Well, Dr. Nicole Kane, you have left us with some really great nuggets today. The book is called Panic Proof. It is just out. Thank you so much for joining us today. What a great conversation.
It's been an absolute joy. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Now, you've heard these recent scientific declarations. Our gut is our second brain, and our microbiome determines our entire existence, and things like this. Now, you know, That thing, the gut, how can this be? The thing that embarrassingly gurgles and bubbles and grumbles when we feed it the wrong things or perhaps maybe have the wrong emotions. Well, our guest, Elsa Richardson, has written a whole book on the gut. It's The Curious History of the Gut, and she calls it the most fascinating organ. Elsa's an academic at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, and she lectures on the history of medicine, among many other pursuits. And she joins us this morning to discuss her new book, appropriately titled Rumbles. Elsa Richardson, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I think this book is pretty fascinating that you're really looking you go way back in history, the history of the gut. And we think that this is very current science that we're figuring out, calling the gut our second brain, and some people even call it our first brain, but that they've been talking about this for a very long time. How far back did we start considering what this sort of embarrassing organ was doing?
I think that as long as we've thought about our bodies in a serious way, we have recognized a connection between the gut and the brain. And the idea that it is new knowledge in any way, that our gut may be our second brain, or as you put it, our first brain, certainly doesn't hold up when you look into the history. So for example, to give a kind of very old example, I looked at the work of Galen, who's the kind of, you know, the famous archetypal Roman Greek physician. And he was convinced that the stomach possessed its own kind of intelligence. So for him, there was a kind of central ruling intelligence of the mind, sure, but he argued that the stomach had an intelligence which was separate from the mind. And the reason that he did this, or the grounds on which he did this, was that the stomach was capable of registering its own emptiness. And that for him suggested that it had its own special kind of brain power.
Wow. It was able to register its own emptiness. And by this, I assume that you're talking about that feeling we get when it's empty, and the possible sounds that come from, you know, the gut that's protesting, right? To
yes,
us, to say,
absolutely.
Feed me.
Yeah, completely. And also, interestingly, Galen's recently, well, not even so recently, Galen's idea that, you know, that the stomach had this kind of autonomous intelligence was actually kind of backed up by hormonal science in the latter part of the 19th century, which discovered the enteric nervous system. So the nervous system which governs, gut. All things gut. And what, you know, the scientists who discovered that found out was that that can also, this nervous system, this part of our nervous system, can operate independently from the central nervous system, which again suggests this peculiarly autonomous region in the body.
My family has a lot of gut maladies. There's some Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, gluten intolerance, celiacs. Do you think that these are recent happenings based on, you know, all kinds of geo-modified foods and things, or have they always been around and we just understand them better?
That's a really good question. So, I mean, part of the impetus for this book came out of my work with a project called the Scottish Gut Project, which was looking at basically kind of trying to bring science and the humanities together with patients groups to kind of better understand, I guess, the way that kind of imagination, metaphor, and language impacts those who are suffering from gut conditions. So basically thinking about the kind of the power of, you know, how we describe how our gut is feeling in relation to a kind of more medicalized diagnoses. And, you know, one of the reasons that we got together and, you know, put this project, the Scottish Gut Project, together was based on the fact that in Scotland there are rocketing incidents of IBS, of Crohn's, of other chronic gastric conditions. So on the one hand, I think that it does seem that many of those, you know, types of conditions are on the rise, or certainly there seems to be good evidence of that. On the other hand, I think that when you look into history, what you discover is that the gut has long been a troublesome actor in the body. So I am by specialism a 19th and early 20th century British historian. And in my book, I describe this as a kind of, as the kind of golden age of constipation, in a way, because everyone was, it does seem that everyone really had terrible problems with constipation in this period. There was a lot, such a huge market for patent medicines directed at easing constipation. But not only that, there was an awful lot of fear and anxiety attached to the problem of constipation, right? So this was, I think, similarly with something like IBS today, many medical writers and thinkers described constipation as being in some way evidence that the speed of modern life and the nature of modern life was kind of overrunning our physical capacity to deal with it, right? So for someone writing the latter part of the 19th century, constipation, I think like IBS today, was seen as kind of evidence of the body's kind of protest against exactly the same things that we worried about now, so processed foods, too much work, too much stress.
Wow, that's so interesting to think of it as a remark on what's happening in our world. I bet as a kind of a cultural historian, this is just totally right up your alley. And things like, we're also hearing a little bit about leaky gut syndrome or brain fog related to things we eat. Do you think these are real conditions, or are they just ways people are trying to describe new things that are happening with the gut?
Leaky gut syndrome for me is extremely interesting. And I don't think I have any firm answer on whether this is quote unquote real or not. Certainly the scientific literature that I've read around it is fairly skeptical of this as a kind of, as an actual condition. However, for me, I guess as a cultural historian of medicine, it's really fascinating because it seems to me to be a revival of some of the ways that we've thought about our gut in the past as being a kind of storehouse of dangerous material. So specifically, in the book, I look at this figure, William Arbuthnot Lane, who was a very famous and respected surgeon working in the kind of latter part of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century. And he became really obsessed with constipation, absolutely obsessed with the problem of constipation. And for him, the problem with constipation was due to something that he called auto-intoxication. So his idea being that when half-digested matter sat in the bowel for too long, it would begin to fester and then leak out poisons through the bowel walls into the rest of the body. And for him, that caused all kinds of mischief. So that might include things like, cancer, infertility in women, bad mood, brain fog, as you put it. And for Lane, really this was kind of the problem of his age as he saw it. So for him, most conditions could be traced back to a kind of infrequency of bowel movements. And what I think is interesting with this idea of the kind of leaky gut, the leaky gut syndrome, is that I think it kind of frames the gut in a similar way, or understands the gut in a similar way, as being somehow a storage facility within the body that is filled with matter which is toxic to the body, and which sees the gut as being a space that is kind of filthy and impure in the body, and which is always threatening to kind of, burst its banks and release, unwanted matter back into the system.
Hey, we warned you all that this was going to be a discussion about the gut. So
yeah, exactly.
We are fulfilling our promise.
Well, exactly. It makes me wonder if in throughout history, there was all this discussion of the gut and there was all this, say, fear around constipation, as you say. Was there a period of time that we decided that that was very inappropriate sort of talk? And we were hush hush about the gut and the things that could go wrong with it, because it seems to me now that even, I mean, maybe until you get to a certain decade of age that you just don't talk about these things, even now?
That's a really interesting question. I think that one thing that becomes apparent when you look into the history of the gut is how often our ideas, especially in a kind of Western context, our ideas of what it is to be civilized have been formed in reaction to or in relation to the gut and its products. So I'm thinking here of, you know, something like the Great Exhibition, which was staged in London in the mid-1850s, in which one of the kind of, so the Great Exhibition being this kind of, you know, massive display of Britain's, you know, colonial wealth, its industrial technologies, its arts, its crafts, basically this kind of great celebration of everything that Britain in the Victorian period thought of itself as being, right? Civilized, industrious, you know, the pinnacle of, you know, the world in a way. And one of the most popular exhibits at the Great Exhibition, one of the most frequently visited and the most lauded exhibits were the first flushing lavatories. So this, you know, the phrase, I don't know if this is very British specific, but I don't know if you've ever used the phrase spend a penny. So sometimes if you want to be polite in Britain and you say, you know, that you need to go to the bathroom, but you don't want to say that, you'll say, oh, I have to, you know, spend a penny. And basically that means, you know, I need to go to the loo. And that comes from the Great Exhibition, because they had these, you know, these, the kind of these first flushing lavatories that people were able to use. And in order to use them, you had to spend a penny to get in to use the lavatories. And I feel like, I guess that part of what I'm getting towards in terms of getting, you know, thinking about the bathroom and the loo here, is the way that so often how we dispose of the kind of waste products of the gut comes in some way to signify more than that. It says something about our ideas of ourselves as civilized, right? This idea that to have a kind of clean, civilized city, for example, what is required is that all of the wastes of the body move underground in sewers, right? Are hidden from view.
Yeah. Spend a penny. I think I'm going to adopt that term. No, we don't have something like that. We say awkward things like, oh, I'm going to visit the ladies' room. Or
I think we can bring spend a penny back.
Well, spend a penny. Some crude boys will say, I've got to go drop the kids off at the pool.
Oh, oh right, God. Right.
I do like that.
I can't
that
even
one.
Imagine what that means.
When I first picked up your book, Elsa, and by the way, we're speaking with Elsa Richardson. Her book is Rumbles, A Curious History of the Gut. That's the secret story of the body's most fascinating organ. Okay, historically, if I think about what I know from history and how the gut responds to things that we put in it or don't put in it, I think of two things, gout and scurvy. And they're very different in that gout was called, wasn't it called like the rich man's disease? Mm-hmm. Because it really came from eating all these very rich foods. And then scurvy, of course, is a lack of vitamin C. We think about sailors. They didn't know that they could just take one little slice of orange and they wouldn't get scurvy. But can you talk about those two things in particular, starting with gout? I think that's just fascinating.
That is really a good question. So gout, to speak to gout, I am obsessed with, and I think secretly in love with, an 18th century physician by the name of George Cheney. So George Cheney is one of my favorite figures from history. And he was trained in Scotland and then moved down to London to start up his business as a doctor, as a physician in the early part of the 18th century. And in that period, what that involved was a lot of wining and dining. So it involved, you know, going out to dinner with possible patients, networking with your fellow doctors. It meant drinking a lot and eating a lot of heavy foods. Now, alas, poor George ended up in quite a state. So he found himself to be quite overweight. He was unable to walk unaided. He was covered in these like disgusting ulcers, as he describes it, from all of this kind of, you know, overeating. And he was, of course, plagued by terrible gout from all of this kind of overindulgence. And so what he did was he put himself on a diet. And he, you know, he restricted himself to, as he puts it, 1 pint of wine a day, which I think is, you know, I would say probably more than adequate for most of us now. But also a diet of, you know, just vegetables, milk, no meat, you know, fruits, very kind of plain foods. And then in the guise of any good self-help guru today, he ended up writing a book in which he recommended this diet to his fellow, fellow Londoners, I guess, in this case. And he wrote this book called The English Malady, which he published in the latter part of the 18th century. And in it, and part of what is so interesting about him for me, in it, he describes this kind of national constitution or a national temperament, the national temperament of the English, as being melancholic. You know, so we are, you know, British people suffer from this terrible melancholy. And he suggests that one of the reasons for this is diet, is down to diet. So he suggests that, you know, this excessive diet of too much, you know, rich and roasted meats, too much wine, you know, too much overindulgence has basically led to a kind of nervous derangement in the nation, and which is causing all of this kind of, you know, basically what we would now describe today as kind of poor mental health or low mood. Now, he sells this book, The English Malady, and on the grounds on which he sells it is that, you know, to have this kind of nervousness, to be melancholic, to be gouty, let's say, is also a marker of a kind of social status, right? Because as you put it, to, you know, gout is associated with rich and fine foods. So what's really interesting about The English Malady as a book is that it's selling, it ended up kind of selling melancholy as a kind of almost like a kind of fashionable disease, almost like a kind of desirable disease, because to have it, you know, it was a marker of status, a marker that you could afford, let's say, to be gouty.
That's a really fascinating story.
And then in terms of scurvy, I don't think I really have anything to say about scurvy, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
Nothing interesting anyway that I can think of off the top of my head. So.
Well, our understanding of the gut, I discovered in your book, has its roots in some pretty horrific historical experiments on dogs. Mm. Aside from waking the world up to seeing animals as sentient feeling beings and drawing attention to some ethical issues of cruelty in animal testings, what did we learn from those experiments?
Well, I mean, yeah, beyond the issues of animal cruelty and, yeah, and the tragic fate of several very adorable brown terrier dogs. I mean, awful. Part of what we learned from those experiments, which were undertaken at University College London in the latter part of the 18th century by two physiologists, William Bayliss and Edward Starling. I think Edward Starling was married to William Bayliss's wife. So it was very like, wait, let me start that again. Or just cut that. That doesn't make any sense. He was married to William Bayliss's sister. So it was all in the kind of family. So anyway, sorry, these experiments were undertaken by two UCL physiologists, William Bayliss and Edward Starling. And what they were doing in these with these experiments was attempting to, for the first time, map what would became known as the enteric nervous system. So this nervous system in the body that governs all of your kind of gastric processes, so digestion, absorption, all of that processing that goes on in the gut. And what they discovered and what became, you know, was the most significant discovery was, one, they discovered the existence of hormones in the body. So before that, we didn't really know about hormones. Two, they discovered this close connection between, you know, the operation of certain hormones and the work of the digestive system, the work of gastric process. So poor little dogs, certainly awful for them, but we did discover some quite important information from those experiments.
It sounds like it. And also, so if you're a lover of just kind of interesting cultural history, this book, Rumbles, will really appeal to you. There was also a fascinating section about cheese dreams. Do you feel that our food affects the way we dream or our subconscious?
That's a great question. Yeah, I do enjoy the cheese dreams. Part of what I find interesting about the cheese dream research, and I love saying that sentence, my cheese dream research, was the cultural differences which were flagged. So the British Cheese Board, get the pun, conducted this survey among British people and found that certain cheeses produce certain types of dreams. So they found, I think it's cheddar encourages dreams of celebrities, Red Leicester, strange dreams, blue cheese, erotic dreams. I can't remember what it was, but basically different kinds of cheese seem to induce different kinds of dreams in the dreamer. But what other research has pointed to is the fact that this is not culturally consistent. So Brits and Canadians and Americans all report this kind of strong correlation between eating cheese and having quite kind of strong, nightmares or very vivid dreams at night. But Italians and the French do not report anything like this. So for Italians and French, two cultures which we would associate as, eating quite a lot of cheese and being quite pro fromage, do not seem to have this, do not seem to experience these kind of similar nocturnal events. And I guess part of what that might point to, which I think is extremely interesting, is the way that, dreams, though we might think of them as being, psychological or physiological, I think also have some cultural component, right? That they're also in some way formed by the culture and the society that we're sitting in. And I think that one of the things we might think about the stomach as doing is maybe kind of mediating between those different spaces. So between kind of the psychological, the physiological, and the cultural.
Well, I'm from originally from Illinois, which is adjacent to Wisconsin, which is the home of a lot of American cheeses. And I think that they should get on board with this idea and sell certain cheeses to promote certain kinds of dreams. Americans would jump all over that.
I'm completely behind that. I think a good English cheddar could do some work there too.
Got to promote English cheddar.
Okay. Yeah, always. I got to get, they're paying me.
Yeah, exactly. The cheese board. Well, it's funny when you talk about doing research that includes which type of cheese makes you dream, have this certain type of dream. It makes me wonder about some of the other types of crazy research that you found while researching your book on what happens in your guts. I mean, I would love to hear a soundtrack of what exactly is going on in the gut because it makes such strange noises. But does something come to mind about the crazy research?
Well, it's very interesting that you asked me that because it has been on my mind because I was at a festival, a literary festival this weekend, and I was speaking to someone who I shall not name because of the private things I'm about to reveal about them. But they were telling me that they had recently gone through a quite serious operation. Their intestines had become tangled, which is, sounds incredibly disturbing. And first fact, the way that they deal with that, as an operation, they basically open you up and unspool your intestines out of your body and disentangle them. Then they have coat hangers that they hang around the surgical room, which they kind of hang your intestines up on.
This is current.
3 years ago that this operation occurred. Isn't that remarkable? Isn't that wonderful? Imagine all of your inside, really outside. Anyway. So he was telling me about this operation. And then I said, how did this come about? What happened with the diagnoses? How was this diagnosed? And he said, I went in and I had some stomach problems. And my physician said, right, okay, listen, I'm gonna listen to your stomach. So she kind of put a stethoscope up to his gut and gave it a good listen. And from just listening to the noise that his belly was making, she was able to diagnose correctly what was going on in there. Isn't that absolutely remarkable? So from just listening, she could tell that the intestines had become tangled.
Wow.
So I think it's really it's fascinating. There's also this team in Australia who I talk about in the book who are, have been trying to perfect this listening. So have been developing this kind of gastric sonic belt that you can strap around your stomach and which would allow the physician to kind of more carefully listen to the modulations of the gut. And the reason for this is that apparently IBS is extremely difficult to diagnose, or it takes a very long time to diagnose, and involves a lot of kind of ruling other things out, let's say. And one of the easiest ways to diagnose IBS apparently is through listening to the gut and listening to the peculiarities and modulations that the stomach is making. So it's really remarkable, you know, what our kind of stomach rumbles might be able to tell us.
Oh, that is just fascinating. Okay, I'm going to try to think about through the rest of the day who you may have been talking to, because the fact that you didn't mention their name must mean that they're sort of a celebrity.
I just really hope they never listen to this program because I'm going to really be in trouble.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and the book is equally fascinating. It's a mix of history and culture and health and everything about the curious history of the gut. The book is Rumbles, and our guest is Elsa Richardson. Elsa, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. This is really fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.